Just imagine you are Siegfried von Westerburg, Archbishop of Cologne in the year 1288. You are regarded as one of the most powerful rulers in the empire. And now you sit here in the dim light of a single oil lamp in your sparsely furnished little private chamber at Brauweiler Abbey, located in what is now Pulheim. Where monks would normally walk silently through the corridors, everything in and around the monastery is now filled with your warriors and those of your allies. Despite a large army of 3,500 knights alone, the opposing side can muster only 2,400, you are faced with a bitter realization. Tomorrow, you would go into battle, and one of the main opponents, the citizens of your own capital city, Cologne. What had you not done to appease the self-assured citizens of Cologne and win them over to your side? Privileges restored, peace preserved, you had sworn to one another never to stand against each other in opposing camps. Just a year earlier, in 1287, you had even renewed the treaty of friendship with the citizens of Cologne. They had sworn before God to uphold it. And yet, the last few days had shown the citizens of Cologne had broken their word and had joined the opposing side out of pure opportunism. Tomorrow, on 5th June 1288, a Saturday, it would be decided who was in the right in this conflict that had been smoldering for years, the Limburg War of Succession in the northwest of the empire. The battle would be a trial by combat. Whoever won would surely have God on their side. Moreover, this 5th June 1288 was the feast day of Saint Boniface, the Apostle of the Germans, as he was called. Could therefore be a more significant day than tomorrow to decide who would gain or retain power on the Rhine? And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne. My name is Willem and I'm leading you through 2,000 years of Cologne's history from the Romans up until our present day. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, as a microcosm of European history. The perspective I've just outlined may seem unusual to some, for the Battle of Worringen, well known here in the region, is always viewed from the opposing side, the city of Cologne and its citizens who were under the rule of the Archbishop and were now striving for freedom through this battle. As you heard right at the start, that wasn't quite how it was, despite what is still widely believed in popular culture today. Dear listeners, ever since this podcast began 6 years ago, I've been waiting for this event in Cologne's history to happen. And now the time has come to set off for the Fühlinger Heide near Worringen on that 5th of June in the year 1288. Let's go out there together in this episode straight after the intro. Welcome to the day before the Battle of Worringen, the battle that was to have a lasting impact on the northwest of the empire and this part of Europe. And at the very last minute, Cologne got involved too. Here you'll find out why it wasn't just any ordinary battle. Historians love to draw the big picture. Some even seek the starting point. Historian Vera Turinsky sees the tipping point for this conflict in the year 1180. That is almost exactly 100 years before the Battle of Worringen took place. Remember, this is the year when Cologne began building a new city wall, but the Archbishop of Cologne also had something to celebrate. He was granted the Duchy of Westphalia by the Emperor. And with that, he had finally arrived in the top tier of the Empire, much to the displeasure of all the other secular rulers in the region, precisely those we discussed in the last episode. For the opposing side was not just about Limburg, Berg, Brabant, Jülich, ultimately Cologne were all intent on weakening once and for all the immense power and supremacy of the Archbishop of Cologne as a secular ruler along the rivers Rhine and Weser. And it is precisely this conflict and this quest to weaken the Cologne Archbishop that has now been going on for over a century. Remember Engelbert of Berg, who constantly strove to expand his rule as Archbishop and even paid for it with his own life in 1225. This brings us full circle, viewing Cologne's city history as a microcosm of European history, or in this case, supra-regional history. The people of Cologne were fed up with the Archbishop's great power. This is the local level and the narrative arc we have already covered in dozens of episodes. On a super level, super regional level, however, the same thing is happening with the Limburg War of Succession. Other rulers and nobles, nominally and de jure subject to the Archbishop of Cologne, are rebelling against the Archbishop of Cologne. Why am I telling you all this? Well, historians like me like to be spoilsports, because particularly in Cologne, the story is often reduced to the following. The tyrannical archbishop fighting against the freedom-loving people of Cologne. And don't get me wrong, the citizens of Cologne were indeed seeking greater freedom. In the end, however, it is like almost every armed conflict in human history, a struggle among the powerful for, yes, power, of course. It is not a conflict of good versus evil. What did it matter to one of the now 40,000 average inhabitants of medieval Cologne whether they were ruled by a bishop or a few dozen wealthy merchants? But history, for the most part, right up until the 20th century, is almost exclusively a history of power. And let's be honest, despite many conflicts, the archbishop and the wealthy citizens of Cologne often lived the good life. They had benefited immensely from each other. The fact that Cologne was the largest city in the empire at the time would not have been possible without the other. The archbishop waged wars in the region and built castles, all this to expand his territory, which ultimately benefited the wealthy citizens of Cologne as well. But waging wars and building castles costs a lot of great deal money, money that the archbishop had to borrow. And who was happy to lend it to him? The citizens of Cologne, with interest, of course. And yet here, they were facing each other in opposing camps, literally. The archbishop fought on the side of Luxembourg and Geldern, the citizens of Cologne on the side of Brabant and Berg. Why this happened was the detail I've been keeping from you so far. So let's finally get into what all this has to do with Cologne and the fact that the battle wouldn't have happened at all without Cologne. Yes, yes, I admit, I've been beating about the bush a bit, but I hope I've learned a thing or two since the German throne dispute here on the podcast and wanted to gently introduce you to the big topic of Worringen. The Limburg War of Succession had already been raging for half a decade, and right from the start in 1238, the city of Cologne did the following. Absolutely nothing. They stayed completely out of it. The archbishop, for his part, was fighting in his camp against the forces of Brabant and Berg, of course. They adhered to the Treaty of Friendship between the city and the archbishop, which stipulated, among other things, that neither party was to join an alliance hostile to the other. This alliance was maintained right up until almost the very end, mere moments before the battle. On 12 July 1287, less than 11 months before the massacre on the Fühlinger Heide, the cooperation, the treaty was reaffirmed. And there was more. The archbishop had some attractive incentives in store to win over the city of Cologne. New custom duties, which Siegfried von Westerbork had additionally levied in his domain to finance his participation in the Limburg War of Succession, did not apply to the people of Cologne. They were exempt from it. Other custom duties already in force would be automatically suspended as soon as the war was over. This met with general approval among the powerful figures within Cologne citizenry. Both the jurors and the emerging Cologne City Council voted in favor. And yet, less than a year later, they found themselves on opposing sides. What happened? The year 1288, let's begin with that, was just around the corner and the conflict was clearly heating up. The year began with an initiative by the Archbishop of Cologne, who invaded the territory of Berg and laid it waste. Virtually every ruler, great or small, in the northwest of the empire had by now joined one of the two warring parties. All except Jülich. Jülich, the county of Jülich, was, as we noted in the last chronological installment on the participants in the battle, I had simply assigned them to the Brabant Berg camp. That was only half of the truth. I had deliberately withheld something from you. Until at least 1287, Jülich was still in the camp of the archbishop from and Luxembourg and Geldern. But in a stroke of diplomatic genius, Brabant managed to persuade Jülich to switch sides. A bitter blow for the Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried von Westerburg. Previously, the county of Kleve had declared itself neutral in the conflict, an old ally of the Archbishop of Cologne was therefore missing. Don't get me wrong, the Archbishop of Cologne is still a powerful man and leads a powerful alliance into battle. He himself fielded several thousand knights alone, but the strategic momentum was swinging in the opposite direction. And in Cologne, the realization was slowly dawning that renewing the Treaty of Friendship a year earlier in 1287 might have been a mistake. Had they backed the wrong horse? Let us run through this thought experiment from the perspective of Cologne's wealthy citizens. Two scenarios were possible for the outcome. First, the Archbishop of Cologne won the Limburg War of Succession. The Luxembourgs would take over Limburg. For the city of Cologne, this would not have any direct negative consequences, but the knock-on effect that this outcome of the conflict would have weighed all the more heavily. A victory for Siegfried von Westerburg's alliance would mean that he, the Archbishop, had successfully defended his power in the northwest of the empire. All his immediate neighbors would be defeated and checkmated for several years, perhaps even decades. Among them were many with whom the city of Cologne had often successfully allied itself against an overpowering lord of the city. A victory over Limburg would give the Archbishop a free hand. Cologne, for its part, would scarcely be able to rely on regional allies from outside the region, and would the Archbishop really then reduce the customs duties and taxes he had introduced during the war, as he had promised? What would prevent him in the event of victory from simply retaining them? After all, he had not allowed the Archbishop's custom castle in Worring to be demolished for years, despite his promise to the people of Cologne. So that was scenario number one. The second scenario that might happen after the war ended was the Archbishop, Luxembourg and Gerdan lose the Limburg War of Succession. If that were to happen, it would trigger an upheaval in the northwest of the empire. The entire regional power and governance structure would be rebalanced, above all by the victors under the alliance of Brabant and Berg. If one were to side with the city's lord, the Archbishop of Cologne, that would be extremely bad, because the city would then be hardly in a position in the future to play an active role in shaping events, and if the Archbishop was no longer successful abroad, his attention might turn back to his old sphere of influence, above all to Cologne. So, you can see, the conflict does not actually affect Cologne directly. The citizens of Cologne couldn't care less who rules in Limburg. But everything surrounding it, the scenario that goes hand in hand with it, namely the reorganization of power along the Rhine, Meuse and Weser River, naturally affects Cologne. At the end of May 1288, just a few days before the battle, a delegation of Cologne citizens arrives in Brühl, today a direct suburb of Cologne. The town, which belonged to the Archdiocese of Cologne, had at that time been conquered by the troops of John of Brabant. Had the Cologne delegation traveled to Brühl on its own initiative, or had Duke John of Brabant requested this meeting? Opinions are divided on this. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. We know how the meeting ended, though. Cologne shifted from its previous neutral position to the Brabant-Berg camp. For Duke John of Brabant had made an offer that could not be refused. He said something like, what if we joined forces and simply razed that archiepiscopal castle in Worringen to the ground? The one that had been a thorn in the side of the people of Cologne for so many years, the one the archbishop had actually intended to destroy, just as he had once promised. So, yes, how about we join forces and simply raise the castle to the ground together? And the Cologne delegation apparently replied to John of Brabant with an immediate yes. The decision could not have come at a more critical time. For at the very same moment, Count Henry of Luxembourg had ordered his army towards Cologne to join forces with that of Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg. It was thus clear to everyone involved, once all the armies of both warring parties were assembled in the Cologne area, it was certain that a battle would ensue. On 27th May 1288, Cologne and Brabant formed an alliance, and the army of the Duke and his allies, such as Berg, Mark, and Jülich, marched into the city at Cologne's explicit invitation. The fact that Brabant now had Cologne as its base, right in the middle of an area full of archiepiscopal possessions, was a huge success for Brabant. It was, forgive me the modern metaphor, as if John of Brabant had parked a large aircraft carrier in the region, which was otherwise under the rule of the Archbishop of Cologne. And Cologne delivered in the truest sense money, provisions, and Cologne craftsmen built siege engines. The largest and at times wealthiest city in the empire had conspired now against its own city lord. This is also where opinions differ. The often overlooked change of heart by Cologne shortly before the Battle of Worringen is frequently forgotten or conveniently overlooked in popular historical accounts. It does not fit the otherwise convenient narrative that Cologne always rebelled against the archbishop. As a direct line from 1074 of Anna II right up to Worringen nearly 200 years later in 1288. But as I said, until just a moment ago, the city and its patricians had still been in agreement. Many historians describe the actions of the city of Cologne as what, in my opinion, they clearly appear to be, as treason. For in doing so, the city of Cologne had broken the friendship treaty recently concluded with Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg. Yet, there are also dissenting voices. Historian Hugo Stehkemper emphasized throughout his life that it was the archbishop who had always disappointed Cologne and was thus a breaker of oaths. So, who's to blame? Which side is it? That's for you to decide. On 29th May 1288, the army led by Brabant marched out of Cologne. Joining them were the citizens of Cologne, who set off for Worringen carrying their own banner. A white banner, still blank at the time, below etched at the top with a red bar bearing three golden crowns. You know, of course, why Cologne, the city that possessed the relics of the three Magi. Upon arriving in Worringen, they set up camp. The army led by Brabant had around 4,800 fighters, making it several hundred men stronger than the army led by the Luxembourgs and the Archbishop of Cologne on the opposing side. However, the latter had significantly more knights in their ranks. Upon arriving in Worringen, Brabant's allies began the siege of the Archbishop's castle at Worringen, and the siege engines made in Cologne were at the forefront. The besieged fighters of the Archbishop of Cologne could only hope that in a few days the Archbishop's army, along with his allies, would arrive to rescue them. A perfect transition. How did people actually fight in those days? Don't worry, we'll go into the details of the battle another time. You know the classic film scene, two medieval armies stand face to face. The leaders, mounted on their horses, deliver a rousing, heroic speech which, realistically speaking, reaches only the first three rows, whilst the 5,000 men at the backs on sides probably struggle to suppress their coughs or even hear a thing. But then, a piercing scream, the masses break into a full sprint, on foot, on horseback, a thousand tremor, the fronts collide in the center like two gigantic tidal waves of iron and flesh, and the next moment all tactics above chaos breaks out. No formations, no master plan, just a gigantic deadly brawl in which even the proud kings in the purest tunnel vision hack mindlessly at their opponents in a fight for survival without really having a strategy. This is how we know and love it from film and television, medieval battles, and let's be honest, these images have been etched deep into our memories. Dramatically, such scenes are an absolute masterpiece. They make our hearts race. The problem with it all, they have nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do with historical reality. A quick word of warning, I'm no military expert, let alone a medieval military expert. But I have read through Ulrich Lehnert's work on warfare of that era. Although it dates from 1993, it still seems relevant as it is still cited widely on the subject today. There are two things we can state straight away about warfare in the 13th century. Firstly, This is the age of armored horsemen. These could be the knights themselves, squires, or so-called sergents. I can't speak French, you know that, guys. So three types of horse warriors. The knights are the highest elite among the armored horsemen. They own several horses on campaigns, one for traveling, one as a means of transport, for equipment, and of course the war horse itself, which was used only in battle and trained for that purpose. Strictly speaking, only those who had previously received the sword-bearing ceremony were considered real knights. This was a very demanding and above all costly process to become a knight. Even among the high nobility, it was usually only the firstborn son who became knight. The rest remained squires for life. This brings us to the second category, the squires. Mostly young men or noble armored horsemen who had not yet received or would never receive the sword-bearing ceremony, whether because they could not afford it or for whatever other reason. Militarily, however, they were usually just as well as equipped as knights who had received the sword-bearing ceremony. And the final group of armored horsemen are the so-called sergents. So, sergenten. Oh, I have no idea how to pronounce that. This could be anyone, lesser nobles, mercenaries, or armed courtiers. They too had almost the same equipment to offer as knights and squires, though theirs was usually of somewhat lower quality. Nevertheless, I'll be damned if I'm going to differentiate between them all at the time here. When I speak of knights in this podcast, I mean all the three types summarized here under this term. The cavalry was present in such great numbers that the Battle of Worringen became one of the largest battles with knights in Europe. That is the first thing we can note about 13th century warfare. The second is the way in which wars are waged. So, whoever owns land holds power back in the day. That is also costly for them, as it forms the economic basis for the nobility. This is true of all pre-industrial eras. An open field battle was, however, the exception in those times. Usually, a war consisted of a succession of sieges, raids, and minor skirmishes. A clash between the two armies remained rare and the exception. That is what makes the Battle of Worringen so special. The event itself, as an open field battle, and the large number of mounted combatants, including nobility from the northwest of the empire. But why was direct confrontation and open field battle avoided? Nobles, whether knights, squires, or even sergeants, trained constantly, practically their whole lives, in combat. Knightly tournaments did indeed exist back then, but the most common form was not, as portrayed in films and TV series, the joust, that is, the one-on-one combat on a field using a lance. No, it was collective group combat in formation. So they would meet to practice fighting together as knights in formation in those tournaments. In other words, the exact opposite of what we know from popular culture, the knight who fights alone, heroically, and indeed selfishly. I don't want to go into further detail here regarding equipment, weapons, and tactics. There are certainly better sources in literature or in the internet that cover all that. I do, however, want to highlight one aspect to refute the notion that medieval battles were nothing but carnage and mass brawls. How did one know whether one was fighting on the right side, and above all, how did one recognize who the enemy was? After all, there were no standardized uniforms yet. The most important tool here was the banner. The banner served as a leadership symbol, visible from afar and rallying point for the scattered fighters, like a large flag fluttering above the heads of the combatants. As the knights were partly or completely unrecognizable due to their helmets, the coat of arms on their shields, tabards, and horse blankets also served to distinguish friend from foe. In the heat of battle, it was therefore always essential to stay close to one's own banner in order to maintain formation. And how did they communicate with one each other and issue orders to individual units? You are no doubt familiar with this from large crowds. Whether at concerts, in busy squares, or on a packed public transport. often you can no longer hear the person just a few meters away. In this context, acoustic signals were used, such as with musical instruments like trumpets, drums, or the collective shouting of commands. Just like a captain in a football stadium whips up the crowd with a chant, which is then repeated by everyone until it can be heard in the furthest corner of the stands. It might be something like, "Stick together, stick together, stick together," similar. You might recognize this from movies too, but there it's usually just the main character shouting and everyone, all of the few thousand soldiers, understands him straight away. And it's not happening as I just presented. There were commands to change formations, to call for an orderly retreat, or indeed to attack in formation. No messing about on your own. Anyone who fought like that alone wouldn't survive for long, then as now. But if you had all that, well-equipped and trained knights, means of communications during large-scale battles, why then were open field battles so rare in those days? Well, it was a strategy of risk and avoidance, or to put it in more simply ways, it was simply too risky, too costly. Wars in the Middle Ages, including feuds, that is, private wars, waged by the nobility against one another, usually followed the same pattern. They would declare war on each other and then set out to ravage the other's territory. I'm putting rather bluntly here, but for the local civilian population caught up in this, it was a nightmare. They were bystanders, simply used as pawns in their lord's power games. We've already discussed attempts to curb this in this podcast, keyword the Peace of God movement. So again, armies mainly would plunder and make rich haul, as I said, at the expense of the rural civilian population. The aim was to drive the enemy into economic distress in order to then force a peace settlement upon them, which would end the conflict and bring new gains for oneself, whether in the form of castles, rights, territories, or even entire towns. That was also the case in the Limburg War of Succession. For 5 years, each side had been plundering the enemy's territory. Both the countryside around Cologne and that of Limburg itself were ravaged. Now, put yourself in the shoes of a medieval warrior who has made a fine haul, stolen livestock, plundered valuables, and so on. What would happen if one were to attack the enemy directly? Anyone who decided to go into battle risk not only material possessions, but also their own death or costly capture. Since the decision was often only considered final once the leader had been killed or had fled, the main rivals in particular were personally at great risk. We shall see this all too clearly in Wochingen. An open battle simply entails an enormous personal risk. Beyond its military and political aspects, a battle was also regarded as a judgment of God in which everything one had achieved up to that point was suddenly put at stake. The idea was that whoever won the battle had God's favor, and since the victor was regarded as the rightful owner of the disputed territory, one tried to avoid or delay the battle as long as one did not feel absolutely militarily superior, and that will be the case at Wochingen. Both warring parties feel capable of defeating the other directly by military means. As I said, I would like to emphasize this again. It is not mass armies of nation-states fighting each other here. Rather, it is the warring bands of nobles. In these circles, war was often waged as an adventure of the fine season. The aim was to weaken the enemy economically, solely by plundering and pillaging his lands to such an extent that he was forced to the negotiating table. This offered the opportunity to achieve objectives with the least possible personal risk. I really want to emphasize that again, and this was achieved not primarily through pitched battles, but through sieges. These are quite typical. However, they did not usually end, as in the films, with an assault on a fortress, but by gradually starving out the defenders. Just as easily, though, the attackers could run out of steam too, due to the lack of sufficient food supplies, a lack of funding, or an army from outside coming to the besieged aid, so that the siege was abandoned and the besiegers withdrew in time before the reinforcement arrived. but Vorion 1288 is therefore an extremely atypical fair. Please allow me just one final point to conclude. Medieval field battles, when they did take place, were of course no pleasant thing. They were naturally dead and wounded. Many died of their injuries and from infections even after the battle. Nevertheless, we are a long way here from entire armies or units being wiped out, as we know from the two world wars, for example. The noble knights, in particular, had it quite comfortable. In battle, they will certainly have endured terrible hardships. One arrow gone astray and you could die, of course. But the capture of a knight had economic, political, and social reasons. Death in mounted combat was the exception, even in fiercely fought battles. The capture of a wealthy knight or bannerman was extremely lucrative financially, as high ransoms could be demanded for their release. A prisoner was considered valuable booty. For many nobles, raising such sums was an enormous burden. Just think of Richard the Lionheart, for whose release from captivity virtually the whole of England was bled dry. Furthermore, means of pressure were also needed to be able to make peace. After hostilities, prisoners served as hostages in peace negotiations to force political concessions from the enemy. That too would happen in Vorion, and vice versa, but more on that in the next episode. So, let us return to Siegfried von Westerburg in the early morning of 5th June 1288. Day is breaking at Balwalder Abbey. It is the proverbial calm before the storm. Whilst the clergy hold a final service in the dim light of the church and bless the warriors, there is already a bustle of activity outside. The clang of weapons and armors and snorting of horses in a cool morning mist. The warriors from the alliance of the Luxembourgs and the archbishop are now setting out to rescue the besieged castle at Vorion, which has been surrounded for days by the alliance of Brabant, Berg and the city of Cologne. Large sections of the Rhenish nobility stand as enemies against the archbishop of Cologne on this day. A menacing scenario, in theory. Yet, Siegfried von Westerburg feels no fear. On the contrary, as he lets his gaze wander over the ranks of his men, he sees a seemingly endless splendor of banners and lances. He has far more knights in his ranks than the opposing side. As one of the most powerful men in the empire, he feels absolutely certain of victory. For him, the coming battle is a trial by combat. And the archbishop does not doubt for a second that it will go in his favor. His certainty of victory goes so far that he has hundreds of iron chains and shackles carried along in his retinue. His plan is coldly calculated. Once the battle is over, as won, he intends to have the enemy nobles immediately put in chains in order to extort an astronomical ransom. Keep those chains, please, in mind. It's going to get extremely interesting later on. The only question is for whom. Dear readers, the time has come. Next time, the two armies will clash on the battlefield at the Fühlinger Heide. And then the decision will be made. Who will be awarded the Duchy of Limburg? Luxembourg, the candidate backed by the Archbishop of Cologne, or Brabant, which enjoys the strong support of the citizens of Cologne? It's fascinating. This inheritance dispute in a duchy far beyond Cologne city limits ultimately changes the fate of Cologne forever. Thank you for listening, and recommend me further, and auf Wiedersehen.